Talk to me about East Timor a little bit.
Well, the context of East Timor is that it was a Portuguese colony up until 1975, and the Portuguese left pretty precipitously, and the Indonesians invaded and took it over, claiming that it was from their point of view, legitimately a part of Indonesia. And they have a legal argument that they put forward about that, that the East Timorese don't buy, but they alleged that. So it really was a military occupation for 25 years, from 75 to 1999, when there was a plebiscite. After the Suharto regime folded, the successor regimes agreed to hold a referendum in East Timor regarding the question of independence. That was, I think, August or September of 99, and then the vote went strongly for independence, and those forces within East Timor who were allied with Indonesia, either militarily or for whatever other reasons, then withdrew. The military then trashed the country on the way out, destroyed 70% of the buildings, gutted government buildings, including the Land and Property Directorate, which is the equivalent of, the county clerk's office in Colorado, where you register a deed. So, I mean, it's a place where
Records are.
property records are kept, deeds and land titles are registered there. So they trashed that facility, although a copy of some of it was on microfilm and had been sent to Java, to a national archive in Indonesia. But the Indonesians have refused to give a copy of that record to East Timor, or it's part of a negotiation process between the two, trying to settle a bunch of issues. But so meanwhile, the staff of the Land and Property Directorate, the ones who remained behind, who were East Timorese, then sifted through the rubble and got some records and found some things, but it's a really incomplete set of documents. So you've got a very complex situation with regard to land ownership in East Timor. You've got folks that have Portuguese titles, which are pre-75 titles. You've got people that have Indonesian titles, which might be of land that was expropriated by Indonesia. Say somebody left in 75, went into exile because they were associated with the independence movement in East Timor. So Indonesia might have just expropriated that. Let's say a house in the capital in Dili. They might have just taken it over. And then, whatever Indonesian official that was might have then sold it to someone else and been given an Indonesian, and the new person who's given an Indonesian title to that land, and they might have sold it to a third person and a fourth person. So you might have three and four owners over a 25-year period, none of them all based on an expropriation by Indonesia, which would be viewed by East Timor as illegal. And then you might have an exile coming back who left in 75, and he says, "Where's my house?" And here it is, and somebody's living in it, and they says, "Well, I have this piece of paper from Indonesia that says I own this place." And the guy from pre-75 says, "But it's my family's house. We lived in here. We lived here for 50 years. So whose house is it?" So you have those are the kinds of conflicts that are coming up. Also, inheritance, people that died at various times during this whole chaotic period, and then who gets inheritance, and does anybody have any record, or is there any, what do you call it, wills or things that show, how property should be transferred. Then there's a third set of besides the Portuguese and Indonesian titles, the vast majority of the land in East Timor is not owned personally, but by tribe. And then individual families are granted use rights on those tribal lands through an informal process of the tribal leadership sort of saying, "Well, you and your family, you have these, 5 hectares, and that's yours to plant, and you get the results of your labor on that land, but you don't own it. It's still held by the tribe." And those tribal lands then are under a set of laws which are called adat laws. Adat is the traditional legal system, which varies from area to area throughout Indonesia, and even can vary from valley to valley, because you have different ethnic groups and so different interpretation of those traditional legal practices. So you've got three different legal processes, one of which is incredibly varied, the adat system, because it is culturally variable and locally determined, you know, is completely, you know, topsy-turvy if you look across those different areas. But usually within a particular area, everybody is clear upon who's the decision maker and how the decisions are made. It sounds all very simple. However, there's political overlay in that, you know, who was this family that had this? Were they in a militia, you know, funded and given arms by Indonesia? And then did they shoot their neighbors during the, you know, during the 99 sort of chaos? Did they flee as refugees to West Timor for a period of time? Is the tribal, you know, decision maker more allied with the liberation forces, and therefore if a family comes back and claims the land, will they then have a bias in determining whether that family gets to use the land that they may have used for hundreds of years? Mm. But because of the recent political events, and that creates some difficulty. And does it even make sense for that family to come back, because they might be shunned or, you know, attacked or whatever by their neighbors for events that happened. So it's very complicated about these things. So our job,
it sounds like the standards by which you determine whose property it is are completely
variable,
unfirm. Yeah.
Right. And there's maybe, I can't remember what the numbers are, but a very few lawyers in East Timor left. I mean, there are some who were in exile and came back, and a few that were lawyers under the Indonesian system that are remaining. But there are no judges and no courts. Those are all, you know, the buildings were destroyed and most of the judges are gone. There were no judges that, you know, all the other judges during the Indonesian period were Indonesian, and it was all mostly military law anyway, so military occupation, not a civilian rule. So there's essentially no court system right now in East Timor. So that's the challenge that we were working with the East Timorese.
When you say we at CDR?
CDR.
CDR gets a call from...
complicated way to be of entree. After 99, the UN set up an administration that lasted until last spring, 2002. So for 3 years, it really was a UN administration in East Timor. One of the UN advisors to the Land and Property Directorate and the Judicial and the Ministry of Justice in general was a Canadian whom Chris had worked with in Guatemala in post-war Guatemala on setting up some systems there. So he said, oh, I know exactly who can help us here. And so he knew Chris and emailed him and said they had an email correspondence back and forth. The Canadian government agreed to fund some work on setting up a mediation system for land and property disputes. And then it went back and forth, and various Canadian and various UN advisors came and went, and sort of three advisors later, things had settled down. The government had taken over, the new East Timorese administration had taken over, but the Canadians were still willing to pay for this mediation process. So the present UN advisor, who's an Ecuadorian, who works closely with the Land and Property Director, thought that this was a really good idea and really supported it, and worked with the director of the, he must be the director of the Land and Property Directorate, to set this up. So eventually then this all happened. So Chris went out in December and did a basic mediation training program with the guys. Turned out that they didn't really know what their mediation system was going to look like. So Chris actually spent the first couple of days doing a dispute resolution system design to front end of that.
Right, so when you get a call, they say, we want to develop a mediation system to determine who owns what property and how to settle
resolving disputed claims, yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, and that was the UN idea before the CDR. And they said, we know who to do it, CDR.
Right.
But that wasn't, you didn't come in and say, okay, you guys need a mediation structure here.
No, mm-hmm. No. And we also thought that by the time we came in last December, they would have resolved a lot of questions of who the mediators were going to be, how they're going to work at the community level, how cases were going to be received, what kind of cases were in, what kind of cases would not be done this way. We thought all that would be in place, but no, it wasn't. So there was more of a design question, not just training individual mediators, but those larger systems design questions had to be resolved as well. So Chris spent the first couple of days of what was supposed to be a five-day mediation workshop working on dispute systems design. And what they determined was that rather than have the mediators all come from the Land and Property Directorate, that the staff of the directorate that were staff mediators, would work with local leaders to co-mediate cases. Of course, then there's going to be these other political questions about, well, is a local leader trusted? You know, so you have to do some discernment about which local guys do you train up as mediators and which don't you. And I don't know how they're going to do that, but that's up to them, essentially.
So that's not CDR's choice to decide?
No. I mean, it's not our choice to even to designate who the mediators are going to be. Right. That's up to the Land and Property Directorate. So they're the ones who recruited the folks into the mediation training program. And the initial group was all their staff. And those staff members will be mediating cases, but they'll be doing it as co-mediators with local leaders. So we had a mediation program in December, and that was followed up with a multi-party mediation program in February. So looking where it was not just two people, but might involve other folks, neighbors, multiple folks that are claiming something, multiple family members that are claiming inheritance, might involve some tribal representatives as well as individual families. So a whole range of different ways that you might have multiple parties involved. And then in March we went back, and I went on the March trip to do a training of trainers, because they need to train all these local folks as mediators, not just sort of go out and assume they'll be able to be co-mediators, but to have a training program for them. Mm-hmm. there was a subset of the group that we were training to be trainers and go out and do that for folks. And then there's going to be a fourth training, and it's still undetermined exactly what that's going to cover. It could be an advanced mediation program, but there's several other topics that could be part of that. So, I mean, this is a case where really what we're talking about here is institutional development. It's not the same as going out and mediating a single dispute. We're trying to help them set up a system for handling multiple disputes in the context of a society that's trying to recover from, you know, fundamental trauma and destruction, and they're really building a government and all its infrastructure from the ground up. And where a mediation process is going to be cheaper and faster than trying to get a judicial system up and running. They may need, ultimately, some kind of an appeals process from mediation to a land court or something like that. So in the next couple of years, they may be able to set that up. But meanwhile, they have to do something to resolve these disputes. And lacking lawyers and courts and judges, which is going to be expensive to set up, this mediation process seems to make a lot of sense for their context.
Now, it seems that if there were a justice system, that standards could be established by which to determine what property belonged to whom. I mean, there's sort of a trade-off between individual settlements of cases versus large legal rights-based understanding of who owns what.
Well, everything still has to be done within the context of law. So they've passed a land ownership law that determines who can own land. For instance, that law says foreigners can't own property in East Timor. And then they define what a foreigner is, or who is East Timorese, so that needs to cross-reference. It also determines, and that law also provides for mediation of disputes as one way to handle it. But there'll be subsequent laws that will enshrine in law this process of mediation with an appeal to some kind of a land court. Those laws are in draft at this point. There's another law that determines that provides a process for people making claims. And they're in the process of developing the regulations for that, and what the form looks like, and where you can file it and what language it needs to be in and how many copies and what kind of documentation you need to provide along with your claim and those kinds of things. So all that stuff is in development around the land claim. So there is a legal framework, but if you use the power rights interest framework to think about this, for the last couple of years there's been a power framework because there hasn't been any legal framework. So people are just sort of taking stuff and doing what they want because they can, or forcing other people off of land using the point of a gun or whatever they have to do that. Or local leaders who have pretty unquestioned power at the local level may just say, no, this family's in and that family's out. So just bam. Mm. And those are where some of these legal claims are going to come from, where a local tribal leader has made a determination and another family decides that wasn't fair, that there was some kind of bias in there, in that determination. So now the country is in the process of establishing the rights-based framework, which are all these laws and all that. But those legal frameworks will include within it that interest-based provision, i.e. mediation using an interest-based approach to resolving claims. So that eventually those sort of nested paradigms will come together in the process.
Mm-hmm. When you hear about mediation, you hear about win-win situations. You know, it's expand the pie. It's not a zero-sum situation. And it sounds like a lot of these situations are zero-sum, and you get the property and you don't get the property. I mean, how does that work?
It could be, but... during that first training program, Chris got them to tell him multiple stories. So he has like 25 different cases. He has sort of little capsule summaries of those cases and what the issues were and all that. And some of them he then subsequently wrote up into simulations for the following training. And a lot of the cases are just not quite as cut and dried as that. So let's say somebody acquired a piece of land 10 years ago and planted banana trees. And so there's a crop from those banana trees, and perhaps he's also put on a new roof because the old roof was falling down, and has done some other improvements to the property. So somebody else comes in and has a pretty clear-cut claim to that property. You know, the guy who been there for 10 years, maybe with an Indonesian title, one of these transfers, it is ultimately determined to be illegal. And it wasn't through no fault of his own. I mean, he thought he was buying something in good faith, and so he didn't violate law, but he doesn't have a legal claim to the property. So this other landowner is coming back, and then the question is, what do you do? Well, does the guy get payment for the improvements he made to the property? Does he get to find some way for him to get income from the bananas, you know, for X number of years, and then, you know, say in the next 5 years, let's say he gets the banana crops, and he has access to come in and work that, and or maybe he gets all of it for the first 2 years, and then the third year, the other landowner gets a quarter of the income, and then the fourth and fifth year, they split it in half, and then the sixth year, the landowner, the guy that's going to be the full landowner, gets the full value. So you have ways to sort of figure those things out, and then you would resolve the roof. You know, is there the owner would need to over time maybe pay back the value of the roof, or they use bananas as payment. I don't know. There's there's ways to sort of figure that kind of thing out. And the other deal is there some way to do land swaps and other properties that the government has at its disposal, or in the countryside the tribal leaders have, so that it isn't just a cut and dried, well, you're out, you're in, and then does that just leave you then homeless, or is there a way to meet your needs for home? Or to do an issue, you know, some way to do the timing of the transfer that makes it less burdensome, or, you know, provides for some, government resources for subsidy to people who've been displaced due to land claims or something like that, which might be a small amount of money, but enough to sort of get somebody started on finding another another location. Mm-hmm. So it isn't always as completely, you know, win and lose as it might be.
Yeah.
And you find ways to accommodate folks. Mm-hmm. You know, and some people who are sitting in those properties know full well that they don't have a legal leg to stand on. Maybe they, you know, during the chaos, they sort of said, well, I need a house. Mine was burned. This one's whole. I'm moving in. Huh. And then, so, okay, they know they didn't have legal title. Hmm. So you find some way to resolve that. So.
Some people have talked about how in Latin America, in some situations, an outsider, impartial, neutral model of mediation where the person who's sitting there facilitating the conversation doesn't know anything about the parties, doesn't really know the parties, and is just sort of trying to lead an objective conversation, that doesn't necessarily work in some situations in Latin America.
Well, and this goes to the cross-cultural deal.
Yeah.
So in East Timor, we're not giving them a North American model and saying, this is the way you mediate. We're giving them some principles, you know, some fundamental principles of mediation and some fundamental skills, but then they've got to find their own way that works for their context. We've already noticed in watching them role play that they're much more evaluative and directive in their mediation style than we would be here.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to have these, they're going to be co-mediating with village leaders who intimately know the parties in one level or another, who also will understand the cultural context. Because the land and property directorate folks are going to be urban educated, you know, government employees, for them to understand the cultural context in among 33 language groups in this tiny island, some of which are mutually unintelligible languages.
33.
Yeah. I mean, the language difficulties there are really really hard because there's no dominant language. But so, you know, a guy from the Land and Property Directorate that grew up in X city and is working in a case in the countryside with a tribe that he barely knows the name of, he has to depend on working with the local leadership and figuring that thing out.
Mm.
Because the local guy will know, you know, whether that family's legitimately, you know, been there for years and years and those kind of things. They'll also be doing some investigation. The land and property folks have learned a lot about going out and just walking around the land and talking to the neighbors and figuring out who was here when and what happened over the last 25 years, and was there a change in 75, and was there another change when the Indonesians left, and what happened in between, and, you know, who's been occupying the land since 99, and, mm-hmm. you know, who gave them permission to be there, and just all kinds of, just pulling together the facts, which in our context, a mediator doesn't usually do. I mean, we might do a conflict assessment, but that's usually talking with the parties.
Right.
In this case, the mediator is also a fact finder.
A researcher.
Yeah, doing some basic research on a case to get a sense of what's going on. And that means that then they're a source of information in the case, which means it's a different mediation model.
Huh.
So, I mean, you might be interested
to know that's not something that you all suggested. That's something that
it's based on their situation and what they need to be doing and what the role of the land and property directorate staff are. Now, eventually they may get so that one set of staff people is doing the research and providing essentially a file to the mediator, and another staff person is then playing the role of mediation, so they're not mixing those roles. But, you know, they're understaffed and overworked, and so there maybe for a while everybody will be doing everything.